This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Finding the right foundation is harder than ever. Il Makiage makes it easy to find your perfect match online. No store required. With 50 shades of flawless coverage and over 60,000 five-star reviews, the hype is real. Their online quiz uses AI to find your ideal shade in seconds. And with Try Before You Buy, you can try your full-size shade at home free for 14 days. Take the quiz at ilmakiage.com/quiz. ilmakiage.com/quiz.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
This is a download of Farming Today from the BBC. The presenter today, Anna Hill.
Good morning. A poultry plant which had to close temporarily because of COVID-19 has lost more than £4 million.
It's not really fair for a business to be expected to shut down for 2 weeks, not get furlough for their staff, and essentially be expected to set fire to all of their stock without compensation.
We'll have more on that a little later. First, though, today you've probably heard those headlines that there's only enough soil left for 100 harvests. Well, that's never really been proven. But now a consortium of international scientists have published a paper with the first worldwide insight into soil erosion across the globe. Led by researchers at Lancaster University, it showed more than 90% of the conventionally farmed soils in the study were thinning. But the study also found that soil under conservation management fared better. Nearly half could produce more than 5,000 years of harvests. Dr. Dan Evans, Senior Research Associate at Lancaster University, led the study.
There have been many headlines, particularly in recent years, about the world's topsoil could be gone in 60 years or there might be 100 harvests left. But these claims haven't been founded on any scientific evidence. So what we wanted to do and what makes our study unique is the fact that we provided the first kind of evidence-backed, globally relevant estimates of soil lifespans.
So what did your results show?
Well, our results showed some really interesting things. First of all, that 90% of conventionally farmed soils in the study were actually thinning. So this is where soil erosion rates exceed those of soil formation. And 16% of these had lifespans of less than a century. And what that means is that the top 30 centimetres of soil would erode in 100 years or less. If we lose that top 30 centimetres of soil, what we've also lost is all of the nutrients in that soil, the organic matter, the carbon in that soil. The fact that they are potentially a century away from eroding is quite an alarming statistic.
Did you manage to link up whether particular types of farming in particular areas were causing these problems? So the wrong farming in the wrong place?
We studied lots of locations around the world and lots of different farming practices. And there are indeed some farming practices that are better than others in terms of conserving soils. What we found is that more conventional farming practices like ploughing, particularly up and down a slope rather than across the slope. For instance, slopes which could be terraced or could be covered in a crop between harvests. These farming practices, which for so many years now, we've known that they've been particularly prone to erosion.
Are there any ways in which farming can actually build up the soil?
Yes, there are. And the first thing to say here is that there are some conservation techniques that reduce soil erosion to such an extent that they actually fall underneath the rates of soil formation. So soils naturally begin to build. But there are actually things that we can do to speed up rates of soil formation. For instance, zero tillage, for example. This is a conservation technique which allows stubble to be left on the field, those kind of decompose down and build an organic-rich, nutrient-rich topsoil on top of the soil surface. And this is really a speedy way to increase soil formation rates.
Dr. Dan Evans. Now, let's take a breath and a sip because all this week we're looking at drinks, and after months of pub closures, there's a surplus of crops grown to produce drinks. Yesterday we heard how some farmers growing cider apples on contract have been paid to let their fruit rot in the fields this year. But for others who make and bottle cider on farm, the boom in online shopping has been a benefit. Rob Hancock grows cider apples and hops on the Herefordshire-Worcestershire border, and he runs Celtic March's Beverages with his sister Susan Vaughan. They have 160 acres of cider apples, a production plant and a bottling factory, and they've seen a five-fold increase in internet sales. Rebecca Rooney has been to meet them.
This is the Dabinet apple. This is the favourite apple of the cider maker, and this is probably 70% of our orchards.
They look very rosy and shiny. They're actually quite high. We have to get a ladder up there to pick them.
No. We've got a shaker which goes on the back of a tractor which hydraulically clamps the tree and gives it a shake. It's all automated.
And as we walk in between the rows of the apple trees, in terms of the heavy rains this winter, how has that affected your orchards?
Where the ground was saturated all winter, we've lost a lot of trees. The roots just been in water. We lost about 1,500 trees across the farm out of about 60,000 trees.
Now, before we head back to the farm to see where the cider's made, you brought me to a field alongside one of your apple orchards, and I can see rows and rows of grapes.
Yes, that's right. We've tried to diversify because we're all hops and apples, and we try to put another egg in our basket. So it's a new venture for me and my sister. They were planted in mid-May, and you can see from the growth, it's looking great.
We're just looking to the future with the changes in the climate and the decline in the hop industry, that perhaps 10, 20 years into the future, that we may well be growing grapes on a much larger scale and replacing our hop yards.
Right, so we're back at base, back at the farm.
That's right, I'm just about to take you into the processing shed where we clean the fruit, mash it up and press it. See, there's a lot of expensive equipment in here, which is dormant for 10 months of the year. And then it's a hive activity in October and November.
So we've got some giant metallic silos and something there that looks like an industrial piston. It looks a bit like a steam train engine or something.
That's the press. We can do anything from 5 to 8 tonne an hour.
And then what happens to turn that apple juice into cider?
Well, we let it slowly ferment with a wine yeast we use. When it's ready, we rack it off its yeast and put it into another tank and leave it there for 5 months to mature over the winter and into next spring.
Right, so should we go and have a look at the side of your business where you bottle the cider?
Indeed. Here we have our bottling production line. You can see the bottles being filled, labelled, and then stacked onto pallets, ready for distribution.
What difference has it been to have your own bottling plant?
We are totally in control from the actual growing, planting of the apple tree right through to the selling of our product in a packaged finished format to the consumer. Because of COVID, off-trade sales, sales of bottles and cans rocketed as people could no longer go along to pubs or restaurants. We've been able to do all our own bottling and canning. We haven't had to go to a third party to get our products packaged, where we may have been in a long waiting list and been out of stock for several weeks.
Susan Vaughan from March's bottling plant in Bromyard. The British Association for Shooting and Conservation has welcomed a decision from the government to include shooting on the list of sports exempt from the rule of six COVID restrictions. Also on the list is angling. Now, Bannum Poultry in Norfolk reopened this week after a partial closure because of a COVID-19 outbreak. More than 120 staff tested positive for COVID at the plant, which slaughters 180,000 birds a day. The group also owns 16 broiler farms, rents 19, and has 9 independent growers. Thousands of birds supplying the plant had to be slaughtered on farm, and the company lost millions of pounds. Managing Director Blaine van Rensburg told me what the impact has been.
Not only have we lost our revenue streams for the better part of 2 weeks and a couple of days, we've also got a lot of cost that's locked up in our livestock. And when we can't process those, those costs essentially go to waste. So, you know, if we just look at it from a cost perspective, we're talking in the region of around £3.8 million a week for the 2 week period. And in revenue loss, it's probably around about £2.5 million a week.
That's a massive hit. Have you had any help at all?
No, none whatsoever, other than the public health officials assisting with trying to get the facility reopened from a compensation perspective, nothing whatsoever.
What happened to all the birds that should have been processed during the closure?
From a on-farm perspective, we've had to cull in the region of 400,000 birds, roughly speaking, and those birds would end up in rendering plants to deal with the carcasses. We were able to keep our factory open for a very limited slaughter of around about 40,000 birds per day. Those ended up in Category 3 pet food. And then the balance of the birds that we have managed to move on to some of our competitors or into bulk wholesale markets at bargain basement prices, or in some cases even for free, just to manage those impacts.
And the farmers who grow the birds for you, did they still get paid for what they produced?
Absolutely. We've kept very close to the farmers that aren't a part of our group but are independent growers for us, and have managed the impacts on them quite carefully and made sure that they're compensated for their losses. From our perspective, the 85% of our supply chain are our own farms and our own birds, so most of the impact is internal.
It's a big waste though, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's, as a farmer, it's tragic to see all of that go to waste.
What about staff who had to be suspended from work? Did they go onto furlough? What actually happened?
No, unfortunately not. All of those, our staff have been working right throughout the lockdown period. And as a result, don't qualify for furlough after the 30th of June of this year. So they've had to survive on statutory sick pay.
So what happened to those workers? Because I know you say some of them actually haven't come back. Is that correct?
Yes, we were expecting a large contingent of workers to return during the course of last week, and only about 66% of them returned. Having not been at work for a protracted period, we'd hope that they'd be keen to return to work. Of course, unless they'd found employment elsewhere, which is a real concern for us.
How confident are you it's safe for staff to return?
Absolutely. We've followed all government guidelines from the outset of coronavirus outbreaks in the country. You know, screening between people on the lines, hygiene lobbies that look like something out of a laboratory. So it is a real step up in terms of what's expected of food processing premises.
If you could have the ear of the Prime Minister, what would you say to him that you need?
I would say to him that businesses that have provided key and essential services throughout the lockdown period should get equal and unfettered access to the compensation mechanisms that were available to those that did shut down during lockdown. It's not really fair for a business, and particularly a livestock-related business that works on such tight turnarounds, to be expected to shut down for 2 weeks, not get furlough for their staff, and essentially be expected to set fire to all of their stock without compensation.
So what help could the government give? Bannum Poultry's local MP, George Freeman, pressed DEFRA Secretary George Eustace for an answer in the House of Commons, and this was his response.
We do understand the difficulties that Bannum Poultry are facing, and I know that our officials are in constant dialogue both with the company but also officials in other departments, including Public Health England and the Treasury as well.
Since then, no help has been announced, but Mr. van Rensburg told us he will continue to fight for financial help for the food processing industry. That's all from us this morning. I'm Anna Hill. Our studio manager is Nick Ford, and our producer for BBC Audio in Bristol is Heather Simons.
the right foundation is harder than ever. Il Makiage makes it easy to find your perfect match online. No store required. With 50 shades of flawless coverage and over 60,000 five-star reviews, the hype is real. Their online quiz uses AI to find your ideal shade in seconds. And with Try Before You Buy, you can try your full-size shade at home free for 14 days. Take the quiz at ilmakiage.com/quiz. ilmakiage.com/quiz.